Welcome to our third lecture in Western Civilization. This lecture is about the civilization of ancient Egypt. First, we should get oriented in terms of geography. Perhaps this would be a good time for you to look up a map of ancient Egypt on the internet. And actually, before I do that, I would like to mention, I'd like you to just consider the term orient or to get oriented. If you think about it for a minute, you realize that we often call Asia or the East the Orient. In our day, when we want to figure out where we are on a map or in a compass direction, we are often looking for north, and then we figure out magnetic north and then orient all our other compass directions from there. But in the ancient world, they did not have maps yet, they did not have compass direction yet, and so the way you got oriented or figured out where you were was to face east. Why? Well, because the sun came up every day in the east. And so it's important to keep in mind that this was the primary method of figuring out where you were and figuring out where everything was in relation to that. So to get oriented means to literally turn east. But for our purposes now, for Egypt and our orientation of Egypt, there are several things you need to know about Egypt. First of all, ancient Egypt was roughly 750 miles north to south. It is a very narrow country. Contrary to the way we might normally think of it, Upper Egypt is considered the south. And Lower Egypt is the southern or the northern part, and this is primarily because the Nile is flowing from south to north, and so upper is the higher reaches of the Nile River, and lower is the lower reaches of the Nile River. And then, of course, there's one other region there, the Delta, that triangular region where the Nile River splits and fingers out before it enters the Mediterranean. This is called the Delta. And this, if you don't know, is the Greek letter, or the letter in the Greek alphabet for D. The capital D is a delta. So that should tell you something about who some of the first or most important students of Egypt were, namely the Greeks. They were quite interested and fascinated with the Egyptians, and so much of our understanding of them is filtered through the Greeks. So that's our basic orientation. We should also mention that ancient Egypt was the majority of what we think of as Egypt on a map today. Something like 95% of it is uninhabitable desert. So that brings us to the other 5% or so. To understand Egypt, you have to understand the Nile River. The Nile is the heart and soul and lifeblood of ancient Egypt. And You should also remember that all early civilizations began where? On rivers. They began on rivers because that was a reliable source of agricultural use of water. And the same was true of the Nile. But the Nile is set apart and different, or at least Egypt and its geography is different in many ways, and it's important to know those ways. First of all, the Nile River was fantastic for agriculture. There is a very ancient Egyptian way of referring to the land of Egypt, and that was red land, black land. And what that meant is that you could go to the edge of where the Nile River and its flooding reached every year, and therefore where all that good, fertile silt that got deposited when the Nile flooded every year extended. And you could put your foot on the red sands of the desert, and you could put your foot on the fertile black soil of the floodplain of the Nile River. That was the red land, black land. Ancient Egypt clung to the Nile River. Indeed, modern Egypt clings to the Nile River. Very few people live very far from the Nile. In the ancient world, something like 5 to 6 miles from the river was the furthest you got. So the Nile was a great source of flooding, and we should keep in mind that they loved the flooding because the flooding came at a predictable time every year. It brought enormously fertile soil. It provided water for agriculture. So that flooding was predictable and regular and normal, and you could set your calendar by that flooding. Remember, this is quite different than the Tigris and Euphrates that could be very erratic, that could change their course, and be something of a headache when it came to agriculture. It was a mixed blessing. So the Nile River provides Egypt with this flooding on a regular basis every year. And all of life in Egypt revolves around the fertility and the flow of the Nile River. Of course, there's many other things the river did. It obviously was a form of transportation. In fact, this was the main mode of long-distance transportation because it was so easy. There's hundreds and hundreds of miles of the Nile before you got to the first cataract or waterfall in Upper Egypt. Actually, more of a set of rapids that you had to carry boats around. So you had this long, long way of travel. Of course, the Nile also provides lots of fish. There are crocodiles, which aren't friendly, but they're there. And all kinds of waterfowl for eating. The Nile also on its own produces, or on its banks produces, lots and lots of reeds. And these reeds are famous for many things. Of course, those reeds were what Moses' little ark was made out of. But actually, the Egyptians used these reeds for many, many things. Famously, paper. But they even built their homes and their boats out of these reeds. And the nice thing about a building material like reeds is if your house goes away in a flood or burns up, well, there's plenty of reeds and you can build them again. So this was a great, cheap source. So basically, I want you to consider how much of life was just essentially tied to the Nile River and how a predictable, calm, reliable river gave Egypt a very peaceful, settled, somewhat optimistic view because they had a stable, stable source of provision. Add to that one other geographical fact, and you understand how much geography affects the way people live and where they live. That other piece of geography is the fact that Egypt is surrounded on almost every side, except by narrow passes along the coastal area, by impassable desert. These deserts could not be crossed by an army. They provided for Egypt a geographical wall that isolated them from everyone else and therefore protected them from kingdoms everywhere else. And so unlike in Mesopotamia, where you find walls around every ancient city, the oldest cities in Egypt have no evidence of walls because they had no need for them because the desert was their natural wall. This leads us to now some important pieces about Egyptian history. I should mention here that a lot of the dates that we give for antiquity are guesses and estimates and are constantly debated by historians and archaeologists. And so they're a rough guess, and you should get an overview of the timeline and the sequence and not really trouble about the details. So somewhere around 3100 BC, Egypt is united. All of the cities, north and south, are united under one kingdom in what historians consider the first of 31 dynasties or royal families of Egypt. This took place under a guy named Menes, M-E-N-E-S, or perhaps it took place under a guy named Narmer, or maybe both of them. There's some debate about this. But at any rate, the kingdom is united north and south. And this is symbolized very famously in the traditional headdress of the pharaoh that has a combination falcon-serpent crown. And it is thought that the emblem of the king from the north of the south was put together, and now we have these unified dynasties all the way to the last dynasty and the last pharaoh of the last dynasty, namely the infamous Cleopatra, who dies in 332 BC. So there's 31 of these dynasties, and historians divide Egyptian history broadly into three major periods, three major stretches of time with breaks of breaks of a little bit of chaos in between. We'll get into a little more detail on those in a moment. So, of course, Pharaoh, which is originally thought to have been a name, but eventually becomes a title, much like king is a title, or actually, more appropriately, later on, much like Caesar, a family name, becomes Caesar, an office or a title. So the Pharaoh becomes the main guy in charge. And just as a way of illustrating the power of Pharaoh, the significance of Pharaoh, I'll point out a few things. One of which is the thing that we think about most often when we think about Egypt, the Great Pyramid at Giza. There's three very large pyramids at Giza, but the Great Pyramid, known as the Pyramid of Khufu, is the most notable. This one is built in the 4th dynasty, in the first of these major chronological periods in Egyptian history. And I want you to consider the vast amount of resources in terms of money and manpower and time devoted to this one structure. The structure that was ultimately a tomb. We often don't realize that these pyramids in ancient Egypt were not temples like the ziggurats of Mesopotamia, but were for the most part tombs. So you have this vast, amazing structure that has lasted thousands and thousands of years, and it turns out to be for one guy and his wife. That should give you sort of symbolically how much power Pharaoh had. That should give you an image of the vast resources he had at his command, and how much he could devote simply to his tomb. These pharaohs, depending on their era, and the significance of Pharaoh grows and develops, but some of these pharaohs never touched the ground. They were always carried, or they were on pedestals or platforms. They were thought as too divine or too holy in some sense not to touch the ground. Most of these pharaohs and most of their dynasties marry their sisters because, after all, they are seen as somewhat divine, and they couldn't mix with common blood. This is also why we find some genetic problems in a lot of these dynasties. One other illustration of how powerful the pharaoh could be. Some of these pharaohs, if they wanted to go hunting, what they would do is they would send the army out into the desert in a wide line. And they would have the ends of that line sort of wrap around and make a gigantic miles-wide circle. And then the army would slowly march into a circle and narrow it such that what you had was a bunch of soldiers eventually all pointing inward. And when they did it this way, they would flush out all kinds of animals for the wilderness. And then Pharaoh could just ride through on his chariot and heroically shoot arrows at these animals that were trapped in this ring of soldiers. That's a day of hunting for Pharaoh. So that should give you, again, an idea of how powerful some of these pharaohs could be and how many resources were in their hands. Well, another thing that we often remember or know about ancient Egypt is their collection of gods. They have a vast and a confusing collection of gods. Remember, in Mesopotamia, usually there was one major god associated with the city. There might be other gods worshipped there, but there was sort of one god over that city, and each city might have a different god. In Egypt, because a vast area was all collected and connected and ruled by one guy, there were many, many deities all sort of cobbled together in this huge collection, this huge pantheon. By the way, that word pantheon is a Greek word that means all the gods. So there's this large collection of gods, and many of them were not anthropomorphic or in the shape of people. Remember, many of them have these sort of, there's a goddess with the head of a cat, and there's a god with the head of a jackal, and there's a god, Ra, with the head of a falcon. So there's these gods that are sort of hybrid gods with that are over various areas of life. In fact, it's interesting. Many people think that the plagues of Egypt, the 10 plagues that happened when Israel was coming out of Egypt, were actually directed at particular gods. In other words, they were judgments of those gods, and they were showing that this god doesn't have control over fertility or the night or the Nile. So, for example, there was a goddess whose head was a frog, and it is thought that the message was that the God of the Israelites is not is indeed the sovereign God over all these areas and not these Egyptian deities. But at any rate, we have the many deities. And then the other major famous thing about Egyptian religion is the mummies. So the Egyptians seem to have a much more peaceful, maybe optimistic view of the afterlife. And it is connected to the idea that it seems as though in the afterlife you go on with a peaceful life as before. And in order to go on with that life, you have to preserve the body. If the body rots and decays, then the soul can't go on. Or if the body is absolutely destroyed, then the ka, or the soul, won't last. And so the Egyptians developed this practice of mummification. Now, it should be pointed out that the Egyptians had the advantage of a climate that was incredibly dry, that made it easier to preserve these bodies. But the preservation of a body could take many, many weeks. Those bodies would be opened up, all the major organs would be taken out and put into separate jars. The brain was taken out through the nose with these special hooks that allowed you to pull the brain out piece by piece. The body would then be filled with spices and honey and all these things and salts that we know the Egyptians knew were great for embalming the body. And it's amazing how well preserved these bodies are by the process of mummification. But remember, it was all so that that person's body could last, so that their ka could last, so that they could enjoy life as they had before. And of course, their tombs were filled with all the things they had in life. I should also mention that this practice of burial seems quite foreign to us, but it's actually similar to our modern process of embalming. Of course, we don't take the organs out, but we do preserve the body. And I should also point out, in contrast, that the Israelites that we know of had a process that's not identical, but similar in some respects. What much of the ancient world around Egypt would do is they would put bodies in a tomb, actually in a larger area with holes, alcoves in the wall. They might have a family tomb with many of these alcoves. And you would put a body in there and you would wait for a year. And once the body had rotted and dried out, you would return and collect the bones and put those bones in a bone box. So remember the promise that Jacob made his sons give to take him, or actually Joseph, that when he died and they left Egypt, his bones would be removed. So just to contrast that with the practice of mummification of the Egyptians. Another element of the ancient world that we're, or ancient Egypt that we're familiar with, is the beautiful hieroglyphics. These are just extraordinarily beautiful, highly stylized writing system. It took a long time for people to figure out how to break the code of hieroglyphics. In fact, it wasn't until the 19th century, and after the French had actually invaded Egypt for a time, famously using the nose of the Sphinx for target practice. This is one of the reasons the Sphinx doesn't have her nose, or his nose, excuse me. But at any rate, it took a long time to figure out that this writing, hieroglyphics, which means priest writing, was actually not an alphabet and not pictorial writing, but sort of a combination of the two. It was a specialized class that could learn this writing, much like cuneiform writing in Mesopotamia. And typically, we find it in tombs or on papyrus scrolls. And actually, the one archaeological find that allowed us to decipher hieroglyphics was a basalt, a big stone tablet that had three forms of writing on it. It had Greek that we knew, Coptic that we knew, which was a later, more common form of Egyptian, and hieroglyphic writing. And the French expedition into Egypt in the 19th century that found that found what ultimately became the key for deciphering hieroglyphics, the Egyptian writing system. But hieroglyphics was enormously cumbersome as an everyday writing system. It did not prove to be anything other than sort of a ceremonial kind of writing. So, we've mentioned the pyramids, we've mentioned hieroglyphics, we've mentioned these various things. I should also add that there's these three periods that we said before: the Old Kingdom, which should tell you it's the oldest, the Middle Kingdom, unoriginally, and finally the New Kingdom, that ends again with the reign of Cleopatra. In between those times, there seem to have been invaders that came from the area of actually ancient Israel that invaded and intermingled and created instability before there was sort of reunification and peace. So I want to mention now the New Kingdom, this latter part, and a very interesting pharaoh in the New Kingdom named Akhenaten. Akhenaten was interesting in a lot of ways, but maybe the most tantalizing thing about Akhenaten is that he seems to have wanted to get rid of the whole religious system of the Egyptians and replace it with a form of monotheism. We often call it monotheism, we might call it henotheism, which simply means the not that there's no other gods, but the exclusive worship of one god. So Akhenaten, he wanted to get rid of all the priests and all their systems of worship, replace Israel with one god, or at least the worship, or excuse me, I said Israel, Egypt with the worship of this one god, and he moved his capital south to a place called Thebes, south, but towards Upper Egypt. Tries to establish this whole new system of worship for Egypt. So was he feeling his way towards the idea of one God, much like the Israelites? There's a lot we don't know about Akhenaten, and we're still finding out because his experiment failed. After his death, much of his name and his history was wiped out, and attempts were made to mark him out of the history books, as it were, carve him out of hieroglyphics. And Egypt returned to its traditional polytheistic system. A few other things, though, about Akhenaten are interesting. One is that all the representations of him are actually quite realistic, and we might say unflattering. Throughout Egyptian history, most pharaohs are presented in ideal terms: no fat, very fit and healthy and young and handsome. And Akhenaten is presented with something of a gut, and his facial features seem to be more accurate. We find something with Akhenaten that we've never found with any other of the pharaohs, that is a depiction of he with his wife and his children that's almost touching in the sense that they seem to be a happy little family together, not this awesome, austere royal family. Famously, his wife was Nefertiti, maybe one of the second, maybe the second most famous female Egyptian. And also famously, his son was the pharaoh that we associate as maybe one of the most famous, although he was a rather minor pharaoh, King Tut or King Tutankhamun, who had a very short and somewhat tragic reign because they were trying to get back to the old system and rejecting the ways of his father. This brings me to another feature of Egyptian life and archaeology that we need to know about, the Valley of the Kings. Now, you'll remember I said that the pyramids of Giza were tombs, and actually there are many other of these pyramids. Well, one of the things that the Egyptians eventually realized is that if you make this enormous monument that takes years to build and everyone all around knows about it, they are inevitably going to be targets of looting and robbery. And this is the case with the Great Pyramids. In fact, most of the major pyramids that we know of, we have never found any of the precious items left because they had been looted long before modern archaeologists came along. And King Tut is a remarkable example to that. So later kings, later pharaohs, in fact, all the way into the New Kingdom, realized, well, maybe we better not leave a big sign and say there's lots of gold here. So they began to bury pharaohs in an area called the Valley of the Kings, west of the Nile, out in the desert, in a place that was thought, hey, it's more remote and it will be less prone to looting and robbery. Unfortunately, this did not always work out. Out here in the Valley of the Kings, they would often carve the tombs into cliff faces, build ramps up to them and carve the tombs into cliff faces, and then remove the ramp, bury the pharaoh with all his gold and remove them. Well, robbers, when they knew this, eventually found ways to get into there. But King Tut's tomb was different because it accidentally or unintentionally got covered up by desert sands and maybe these ramps. So it was discovered in 1912, and it was an amazing haul. Most people know the famous gold sarcophagus faceplate of King Tut. As I said, you should know that this was probably a very humble, very modest tomb, and that many of these other tombs had far more fantastic gold and other precious items in them. Think of what might have been in the pyramid at Giza compared to this second-rate, short-term pharaoh Tutankhamun. Also, the expedition that discovered Tutankhamun's tomb, there were several infamous deaths, and this is where the idea, shortly after excavating the tomb, and this was where the idea that there was the curse of the mummy over this tomb to protect it. So, all in all, you should know that the Egyptian worldview, the Egyptian outlook, was very religious. All of life was seen as connected to gods and deities and spirits. The afterlife was very important. In fact, if you just consider the Great Pyramid, maybe the afterlife was everything, at least for those who could afford to consider it. Many people are familiar with the depiction of judgment in some circles out of the Book of the Dead, where the god Anubis, the jackal-headed god Anubis, leads one to judgment, where his heart is put on a scale to be set against the feather of Ma'at, or justice, or harmony. And if his heart was worth or matched Ma'at, he could go on into a peaceful afterlife. If not, he would be, his heart would be gobbled up by a crocodile-headed god there of judgment. Well, let's talk about the legacy of Egypt. What is the legacy of Egypt? Well, one is very important. You cannot imagine the Bible, the Old Testament, without Egypt. All of the most important things, or many of the most important things in the Old Testament, are related in some way to Egypt. Abraham spends time there. His descendants spend 400 years there as slaves. The defining moment of Israelite history, the Exodus, takes place in Egypt. So Egypt will be consequential for Old Testament history. In fact, Egypt is one of the main superpowers. When you go back east to Mesopotamia and the various empires that arose there, Babylon and Assyria and Persia, represent the other pole of superpowers in the ancient world. And you need to know that Israel, little itty-bitty Israel, was stuck between these huge superpowers of the ancient world. And that it was usually when those empires were struggling or having difficulty that Israel was able to grow and succeed and be somewhat independent, but that most of the time they were sort of cowering between these two great empires. Now, another item of legacy. Egypt is fascinating. I mean, their hieroglyphics, the mummies, the archaeology. The Greeks found them fascinating. Many people find them fascinating. But other than being a huge superpower with the resources that the Nile provided, it's interesting that not much of great consequence comes down to us today. There's not a lot of science, not a lot of architecture or philosophy or even religion that remains from the Egyptians. So they're really interesting in terms of their material culture and their religion, but not so consequential. And that's really striking when you consider that itty-bitty Israel, that never was quite as big as it said it wanted to get, that never had any of the archaeological structures that Egypt did, nothing that amazes us like it did with the Egyptians, wound up influencing Western civilization so much more significant. Why is it that a superpower couldn't last, and then a small itty-bitty nation wound up being an enormous significance? Well, in the next several lectures, we'll be talking about why that is.